Chapter 13. Under whose flag? The deeper we have dug into this matter of the Janos people, the clearer it has become that they are, in origin, Earthfolk who have been away from their planet of origin for a very long time. They themselves tell us, "We knew about Earth from the past. We knew where it was in the sky. Looking at you people and the planet, it is like stepping back into one of our own history books. To us, you are living history. You are our people, because you are the same as us." The Janos people say that, although they explored many planets within reach of their ships, to survey them as possible homes, against the time which they knew would come, when they had to leave Janos forever, they never came to Earth, because it was too far. The recent arrival in our solar system of the Great Migration Fleet is their first visit since their ancestors left the Earth, in the remote past. At first sight, this statement appears to create a problem of timing. Flying saucers have been with us for a long time. The and other Roman historians refer to the clypae volans or flying shields, which the Romans regarded as portents. If you take two Roman shields and place them edge to edge, you will have a very fair model of the shape of a typical flying saucer. It is with this analogy in mind that Italians use the word clypeology, where we would use ufology, for the study of flying saucers and related phenomena. Not all UFOs are of the biconvex lenticular shape, with its characteristic dome or blister centrally in the upper and lower surfaces, but it is by far the most frequently reported. The Janos ship visited by our family, described in this book, is of this kind. Reports of unearthly flying machines, fiery chariots and what have you, go right back through history, as far back as ancient Egypt and Babylon. They turn up in the Old Testament, and in the ancient Sanskrit. Are these, then, not from Janos? It is hard to see how they could be, if we accept, as we must, the statement by Uxiolia that they aged by two of your years during a journey of several thousand light years. It follows that their transit velocity was very close to the speed of light, thus the time taken, reckoned by planet time, cannot have been much more than light would take to travel the same distance, and it certainly cannot have been less. In other words, the event of the rockfall on Janos, which precipitated their departure, happened several thousand years ago, by our time. Whatever figure we attach to several, then several thousand years ago, by Earth time, the fleet left Janos on its way to Earth. Nothing can reduce that figure substantially, reckoning by Earth time. If some ships traveled a little faster, a little closer to the speed of light, this would reduce the time the journey would appear to them to take, by ship's time, but I could not think that it could get them here substantially sooner by Earth time, not to make a difference of thousands, or even hundreds of years, unless there is something about the peculiar mathematics of close-to-light velocities that I have missed, being a mere biologist. I am open to instruction. I am inclined to think, therefore, that reports of UFOs before modern times, stretching back into early history, do not relate to the Janos story, but are reports of vessels coming from other planets. The Roman references to flying shields are certainly suggestive of flying saucers, but of course we are not in a position to say that only the Janos people ever had flying saucers. They could have learned the design from someone else. Although we do not fully understand the mechanics of saucer flight, it is apparent from what we have learned from the incident described in this book, that the circular, lens-shaped form of spaceship arises naturally from the need to accommodate the rotor mechanism, which dictates a circular shape. Any civilization employing the rotor mechanism as a factor in space flight would necessarily use flying saucers. For any ship intended for planetary landing and liftoff, it appears, from what John saw and was told, that the rotor spins in order to obtain annulment, annularing, of gravity during liftoff. If we spin the rotor fast enough, there is no gravity to hold us down to the Earth. In space flight, the rotor is still. The big ships, built in orbit, which can never land on a planet, need not be circular, lens-shaped. They could, for example, be cylindrical. Very large cylindrical spaceships have occasionally been reported, of which the most famous example was the one which exploded, a nuclear explosion, 2 miles above the ground in the Tunguska region of Siberia, in 1908, See the Fire Came by John Baxter and Thomas Atkins, for a full account of this incident, which for many years was mistakenly thought to have been the fall of a giant meteorite. More, but there is, of course, nothing to suggest that the Tunguska spaceship came from Janos. Its use of nuclear propulsion power, the ground below is radioactive to this day, might seem a thing the Janos engineers would avoid, but one must remember that the Janos big ships were all designed, built and in use before the nuclear catastrophe occurred, so we cannot, on those grounds alone, rule out the possibility that it was a Janos ship. Whatever its origin, it arrived in 1908, but got into trouble in our atmosphere. Eyewitnesses say it was on fire long before it exploded, also that it twice changed course, showing that it was still under control. One spaceship visit in our history, described in the series Mr. E by Robert Temple, was clearly not from Janos. It is specifically associated with a planet of the Sirius system, only 8.5 light years away. In stellar distance is a close neighbor, compared with the several thousand light years of Janos. Also it is very much so early. The landing tradition is given in ancient Babylonian and Egyptian texts. Babylonian picture seals illustrate the visitors, representing them, no doubt a simplification, as half man, half fish. The Babylonian text says that they taught mankind the arts of civilization, and having remained for a while, they departed whence they came. Another early tradition, from India, given in the ancient Sanskrit texts, also describes, most graphically, the arrival of spaceships bringing people of an advanced civilization, who remained for many years, establishing cities, but they also eventually departed. The Sanskrit account, however, represents them as warlike and quarrelsome, with terrible weapons. The text reads like something out of modern space television of the more juvenile kind, which does not sound like Janos. Again, it is very much too early. Janos ships could not possibly have got here so soon. What all this is building up to is a general impression that there are other space traveling civilizations about, not only Janos, and that this has been so for a long time. Yes. And for those who take time to read the other contact material on this website will know that Janos is only one of many visits to our Earth from space. R.O.REM. The earliest date of any report which seems to tie up with Janos is 1888. This is the year of an entry in a journal kept by a white man who lived among the Indians in the Rocky Mountains, knew them well, spoke their language, and was initiated into the tribe. The story is told by Brad Steiger in Mysteries of Time and Space. The record is in a private diary, which did not come to light for the best part of a century, when it came into the hands of its author's grandson. Some readers may be familiar with the Sasquatch, Momo, Bigfoot or Crazy Bear, an old Indian tradition which in modern times has been revived by many sightings by civilized people, often loosely associated with UFO sightings. The 1888 diary entry is the only source which appears to link the Sasquatch tradition specifically with the Janos story. The link is made in the reported Indian description of the men in the flying saucer, what the Indians call a small moon, as having very short hair and shiny, silver clothes. The author of the diary tells how he was shown a Crazy Bear, a powerfully built naked man covered with smooth dark hair, living in a hut. The Indians told him that, from time to time, a small moon came down from the stars like a swooping eagle and landed. The short-haired men in shiny clothes then pushed one or more Crazy Bears out of the craft, waved in a friendly manner to the watching Indians, a recognizable Janos touch, this, and flew back to the stars, leaving in the minds of the Indians a feeling, perhaps hypnotically induced, that the Crazy Bears would bring them powerful medicine, and that they should feed, cherish and protect them. I have referred, near the end of chapter 3, to Natasha's report that Achilles showed her several films, including one of big, powerfully built naked people, covered all over with smooth dark hair, except around the eyes and on the hands and feet. They were seen first out of doors, on the banks of a muddy stream, then living underground in a cave or burrow, as a family group, with rough mattresses for beds, but no other property. I have little doubt, bearing in mind the 1888 diary link between crazy bears and people who certainly looked and behaved like Jano's people, that what Natasha saw was a film of crazy bears or Sasquatches living on Jano's or, less probably, on a planet near to Jano's, but where the Jano's people knew and visited them. Natasha's only variation from the 1888 diary description is that she says they had green eyes, although the diary does not mention the eye color. Two of the more recent published reports of Sasquatch sightings, the only two to give an eye color, describe the eyes as green. Natasha also said that the hands and feet appeared whitish. This may perhaps have been an effect of dried mud, for they were in and out of the stream. One of the men stooped down and drank from his cupped hands. I have no doubt at all that the many reported sightings of the beings variously known as Momo, Bigfoot, Sasquatch or Crazy Bear, all Indian terms for the same kind of creature, are of surviving prehistoric men or near men. Reading the more sober and less sensationalized descriptions, one has a consistent impression of a powerful, muscular build, height about that of a big normal man, but broader chested, with long, powerful arms. The females, as described, have broad, massive bodies with no waist, and have heavy, pendulous breasts. They have a strong odor, and a loud cry or roar. All are described as naked, and covered all over with short, smooth hair, dark or brown, except for the palms and soles and around the eyes. They avoid contact with normal humanity, but can be aggressive. They are flesh eaters, and live and hunt like a bear. I see no reason to doubt the 1888 diary, which was private, not intended for publication, by a man living close to unsophisticated Indians and sharing their life. There could, of course, be living examples of prehistoric near-human types, still surviving in dense jungle or remote mountain forest. In fact, there are many reports, some of them by responsible persons, which suggest that this is so. There is no reason to assume that they have ever been away from the earth, and probably most of them have not. The Himalayan Yeti or Abominable Snowman is almost certainly one of these. Likewise, certain reports of semi-aquatic wild people from the jungles of Burma. But one group of crazy bears do form part of the Jano's story, if we accept the coincidence of the 1888 diary and Natasha's evidence. The question is, how did they get to a planet thousands of light years away? The answer, beyond any reasonable doubt, is that they went by the same means which conveyed the ancestors of the Jano's people, members of our own human species, and also a primitive type of northern wolf dog, probably accompanying the blonde blue-eyed humans. Although Jano's people do not now keep indoor pets, this does not rule out the possibility that their remote ancestors had the help of dogs in hunting. Frances said the wolf dog she saw in the film did not seem to belong to anyone, it had the look of a wild animal. Again, hunting dogs could have gone feral in the New World. What I am working round towards is a growing doubt about the circumstances in which the ancestors of the Jano's people originally left Earth. There are two, and only two ways in which they could have gone from Earth to Jano's. One is under their own steam, so to speak, by their own technological resources. The other is that they were taken, voluntarily or otherwise, by someone else, not necessarily human. Both alternatives present formidable difficulties, but one of them happened, difficulties notwithstanding. A long interstellar journey at very high velocity represents a level of technological achievement far beyond anything we have at present on Earth, or are likely to have for some time to come. The own steam alternative implies that there was such a level of technological achievement on Earth in the remote past. It implies a scientific civilization far surpassing our own, which has vanished without trace. It is hard to believe that a civilization so far advanced would have disappeared totally, though the obliterating effects of ice and flood should not be underestimated. If such a civilization were confined to a northern area in which it might suffer severely from a late glacial advance. Of course, The legend BF, a vanished high civilization in the remote past, is one of the most persistent of human notions. It goes by many names, of which Atlantis is the most familiar, though the real Atlantis, if it ever existed, was probably much nearer to our own time than what I have in mind. The reader who wishes to go more deeply into this fascinating field will find more material in Charles Bullitt's Mysteries from Forgotten Worlds. But, as far as the Janos saga is concerned, there is a difficulty about the view that they went to Janos by their own unaided efforts. Uxiolia told Francis that several hundred years before the rockfall drove them from their home world, they had made their first space flight to Saturn, their nearest neighbor. In fact, the whole trouble was that it was too near. He told her that they went there, partly out of scientific curiosity, but partly also because they were running short of certain minerals, necessary for their industry. She is almost certain that he meant uranium, and hoped to find new supplies in their nearer moon. As from another read, Contacti Australia in -89, Thiuba, learned that the utilization of uran atom seemed to be normal for algrowing races at a specific level, but also the bad experiences from this, regarding both as weapons and as power. Roe remark, Uxiolia gave Francis the impression that they were then new to the business of space exploration, and inexperienced, so that they made mistakes. The danger from Saturn was perhaps at that time not fully appreciated, and the Janos people were a little heavy-handed with their mining operations. However, Uxiolia emphasized, lavect par, that what had seriously damaged Saturn was the excessive power of the blast off from the moon's surface each time a rocket ship returned to Janos. In those days, they were using primitive thermal rockets, and the heat and power of the exhaust jets caused deep fissuring of the crust of Saturn, loosening the whole structure, so that it had much less cohesion than anyone would expect it to have. It was little more than a heap of rocks, in a round shape. It was this error which caused the Janos scientists to miscalculate slightly the date of the beginning of rockfall. When, centuries later, the distance between Saturn and Janos was so much reduced as to cause instability, the rocks simply came apart. Between any planet and any moon of that planet, there is a balancing point along the line drawn between them, at which planet gravity equals moon gravity. Normally, as in the case of the Earth-Moon system, this balancing point lies between the planet and the moon, though much closer to the moon. But if the moon approaches close enough, a time will come when the balancing point lies actually within the body of the moon. When that happens, any part of the moon's crust which lies above that point, that is, nearer to the planet, will be subject to a negative gravitational field, negative in moon terms, that is, and any loose rocks on its surface will fall upwards towards the planet, slowly at first, but accelerating until eventually they hit the planetary surface with tremendous force, though not with the really high velocity of a meteorite. Once Saturn began to fragment, it would swing erratically in its orbit, until it had completely broken up. Thus it was an early mistake on the part of inexperienced space engineers, using at first far more jet power for blast-off from Saturn than was necessary. Later this was corrected, and just sufficient power only was used, but by then the damage had been done, which caused the rockfall to begin a little earlier than had been calculated. Saturn would have broken up and fallen as a shower of rocks anyway, whether its structure had been loosened or not. The deep fissuring affected only the timing, but this error of timing cost millions of lives. Had the calculations taken fully into account the loss of cohesion of Saturn, due to the excessively powerful jet thrusts of the earliest rocket ships, the Janos people would all have got away safely in the fleet, without loss of life, and Uxiolia's young wife Verna, and their two children, would be alive today. Earth's own moon will one day break up and fall as a monstrous rain of rocks, but relax, this will happen so many thousands of millions of years into the future that the Earth will by then be uninhabitable anyway, because of changes in the sun. If at that remote future date, our descendants are still around, it will be up to them to emigrate in giant spaceships to another planet in another solar system, as the Janos people have had to do. I have emphasized the inexperience in space engineering of the Janos people when they first went to Saturn and caused deep damage to its structure, because it has a bearing on the question, did the ancestors of the Janos people leave Earth under their own steam, or did they go as passengers voluntary or involuntary, in someone else's ships? A really long interstellar flight at a speed close to that of light, such as that from Earth to Janos, represents an extremely advanced mastery of space engineering skills. It seems unlikely that the Janos people, if they had such superlative technology when they left the Earth, would have forgotten it all when they got to Janos, and had to develop space engineering all over again, beginning with little hops to the nearer moon, less than our own present level. This consideration lends weight to the alternative that they went as passengers. This is a disturbing thought, for it implies the existence in the galaxy of other, far more advanced civilizations, which may not be human. The fact that the Janos people, as seen in the ship and in films on the planet, are closely similar to each other, though by no means identical, the visitors, though John did remark once that they all look alike, had in fact not much difficulty in recognizing individuals, suggests that at least all of those seen by eyewitnesses originated from one quite small locality on Earth, certainly in Europe and probably in Eastern Europe. The original group could have been quite small in numbers, maybe no more than a dozen or so as a practical minimum. Certainly they took dogs with them, of a primitive northern wolf dog type. On Janos this type has not been since modified by selective breeding, but remains in its primeval form, which argues that the canine population early went feral. Conceivably, but why? They could also have taken with them a group of more primitive near-men, culturally much less advanced than the blonde, blue-eyed humans who became the Janos people, and perhaps incapable of civilization. All this adds up to the passenger theory being more probable. One would expect the level of civilization needed to provide the technical means of really advanced interstellar spaceflight to be much more broadly based, involving the whole planet. This kind of thing would not be a parochial, village enterprise. It would seem unlikely, in such a case, that the human species could be represented, as seen in one returning ship and its film records, only by one closely defined local race type, the tall, slim-built blue-eyed blonde type which we think of as Nordic, though what little we know of their language suggests an affinity with archaic Greek. I suppose it is just possible that the Janos colony, after landing, suffered a total loss of civilization, and had to learn everything all over again, but it does seem unlikely, in view of their quite definite and precise information about Earth, including the technical data, very complicated of necessity required for navigation back to the solar system. Such information could scarcely have survived a major breakdown of civilization. Also, there has not really been time for such a regenerative process, without putting their original departure from Earth improbably far back into the past. I say improbably, because the Janos people are present-day human in type. If their departure from Earth had been much more than, say, 100,000 years ago, I would expect some perceptible divergence from our present North European human type, and there is none. We could not discover any difference between the Janos people and ourselves. Indeed, the medical examinations carried out on Earthfolk in their spaceships seem to have only one purpose, to reassure them, in scientific terms, that their type and ours have not significantly diverged during their long absence from Earth, and to confirm what they already felt emotionally and by their ordinary senses, that they and we are kith and kin, you are our people, because you are the same as us. Uxiorlia did, in fact, tell Francis that, medically speaking, they could find only one very small difference between their people and ours. The Janos people in the ships have a slightly higher average pulse rate than ourselves, but he said they think that, once they had lived on the ground for some time, even this would automatically adjust itself. They seem, in fact, to set great store by this question of physical identity between them and us, as if it were a matter that they had worried over, and were happy to be reassured about. Perhaps, one day soon, we shall be able to ask the Janos people about their history and origins, in what they have communicated to our English family in this one incident. The subject was not mentioned, except by inference, to us, you people are living history. They have made it clear that they know they are our kindred, Sleninger, but as to how and why they left Earth, nothing was said. I have wondered whether they themselves know the answers to these questions. The why? Is almost more puzzling than the how? What driving motive lay behind that tremendous journey, so far into deep space? Semjay's told that the reason for leaving a high civilization on Earth, and fleeing similar planets in the Pleiades earlier, was escaping from terrible high-tech wars raging here car 50.000 years ago, but also a similar war 196.000 years ago, and also other far wars. Most probably, after some time on new home planets, it started wars between them, that totally broke down their technical knowledge, and they had to start the whole from the start again, and therefore first had to begin with those simple rockets that we hear again on Ariadne is developing. Those Janos people are probably descendants from these space refugees from the past where our galaxy developed through warlike level. For Scandinavian readers, see Jordan's Fjern History I Night Lis. R.O. Remark. Again, if they were involuntary passengers, it would not be their motive which sent them to Janos, but the motives, totally hidden from us, of those unknown beings who lifted them off from Earth, and transported them to a planet like enough to Earth, though it meant a considerable journey, to give them a fair chance of establishing themselves. If their passage to Janos was involuntary, was it part of some grand cosmic design? Was Janos in need of intelligent creatures to colonize and develop it? Who made the decisions? Whoever made the decision to send humans to Janos, made a mistake, or had insufficient information, for it was inexorably written by astronomical forces into the future of Janos, that the planet would eventually become uninhabitable, and that the rain of rocks would drive away the survivors to seek a planetary home elsewhere. Again, if they were voluntary passengers, the same questions arise, except that they would have to be given a compelling reason why they should undertake such a journey. Was this a rescue operation? Were they lifted off to escape being frozen to death in an ice age? On the theory that they were passengers, whether voluntary or involuntary, the higher civilization which took them to Janos may well have given them a helping hand, to enable them to establish themselves, and they may have been taught science and other useful knowledge by their hypothetical mentors. If so, it would go some way to explaining why they are now so far ahead of us, in spite of having lived through something like 10,000 years less than we have, the several thousand years of external elapsed time, occupied by a journey in which they lived subjectively through 2 years only, was so much time lost out of their history, and they did it twice, there and back. On their time account, one would expect them to be behind us stay-at-homes, whereas it is we who are behind them. What are the remaining possibility, that in the Earth's remote past, a group of Europeans of Nordic type somehow had a compelling motive to emigrate to a distant world, and had the technical means to do it unaided? Can we reject this as too unlikely? Certainly we cannot rule it out altogether, though it would require the disappearance without trace of a scientific civilization far more developed than our own. As I have suggested, a late ice age could have obliterated such a civilization if it were localized within northern Europe. Glacier ice in large enough quantities will grind any artifact to powder, and the subsequent floods would wash out to sea anything that remained. A threat from advancing ice could also provide a motive for escape, though to leave the planet altogether seems a drastic remedy, seeing that mankind did, after all, survive a whole series of glaciations, right through the Pleistocene, though each exposure to Arctic conditions would have represented a serious cultural setback. Again, all these problems that the author is bringing up here, get a logical explanation in the history given by Semjay's and reported together with other backup material in book, Norwegian Jordan's Fjern History I Night Lis with material from the Semjay's contacts and the research of Velikovsky. Remember that the scientists does not have any good explanation on the ice age, but this book gives some of the answers to this and other effects. R.O.Rem. It would surely have been easier to move south into more temperate regions to escape the ice, as our own ancestors did, returning north when the ice retreated, in common with all animal and plant life. Given a really high technology, they could no doubt have hung on through the ice age by going under the ice, and living on the produce of the sea under the ice floes. The interplanetary move seems unnecessary merely to escape an ice age. If they went on their own to escape a terrestrial disaster, it must have been because they expected something to happen which would render her whole Earth permanently uninhabitable. If they had spaceships, and the problem were a temporary one, they could have lived in space for a time, as the Genos people are doing now. There is another difficulty: if humans left the Earth on their own technological resources, for whatever motive, they still could not have known that the planet Genos existed. Why undertake such an immensely long journey, as a shot in the dark? If they wanted to settle and colonize, they must have gone past scores of suitable planets on the way. No doubt Genos offered ideal conditions for settlement, but how could they know it was there? However advanced their astronomy, they could not have known the living conditions on a planet thousands of light years away. They would be unlikely to find Genos by chance, and it would take too long. A journey of such a length is, for reasons which the reader will perceive, scarcely feasible except on the understanding that it is done in one unbroken flight at maximum speed, very close to the speed of light. There would be no opportunity for exploration and stopping by the way. Any such diversion would lengthen the time required to an impossible degree, for every stop to look at a planet would involve deceleration to stop, and then acceleration again to close to the speed of light. Such a stop-and-go progress would take tens of thousands of years, unless they possessed at that time the mastery over inertial mass, which the modern flying saucers do appear to have. Even so, it would still take too long. No question of it, they went straight to Genos, and somebody knew where they were going, and had a reason for going there. Any other journey, which other groups may have made to other, equally distant planets, would have to be on the same top speed, non-stop basis, with a destination known in advance. It does begin to look very much, to me, as if the journey from Earth to Genos was organized by someone else. That someone else had a motive for intervening in the affairs of terrestrial men and dogs goes without saying, but what that motive was, is totally hidden from us. Whatever the motive, whatever the plan, it seems likely that the same net, so to speak, picked up at least three groups of creatures from the Earth, probably on the same occasion, something between 10,000 and 100,000 years ago. These were, first, people of European race, members of the present-day human species Homo sapiens; second, people of another species of Homo, closely related to, but distinct from Homo sapiens, and less advanced culturally; thirdly, a kind of wolf with thick, shaggy dark hair, possibly attached to the humans in a hunting dog capacity. The presence of dogs in the Genos story weighs heavily on the side of the passenger theory of their departure. A group of human astronauts, planning a space exploration journey in their own ships, would hardly be likely to take with them a breeding population of big, powerfully built dogs little removed from the wolf. It would create too many problems, and might well be risky. But a gigantic spaceship of a vastly superior culture could easily accommodate men and dogs, and keep both under control. To take the dogs at all suggests that the men were, at that time, primitive hunters who would not be parted from their dogs, not being able to imagine a situation in which the dogs were not indispensable, and their unknown captors indulged them in this, to the extent of taking the dogs along. If, and I am still, personally, uncertain which of the two alternative theories is the correct one, though the weight of probability lies with the passenger theory, if the ancestors of the Genos people were lifted off from the Earth's surface by another and much higher culture, they learned much from it. They were left, also, with a clear tradition of Earth as a planet where they would find people of their own kind, and with a knowledge of how to return to the Earth if they should need to. Whether their ancestors were capable of interstellar space flight or not, when they left the Earth, it is certain that the Genos people are capable of it today, with all the complexities of galactic navigation. One imagines that the big horseshoe-shaped desk which John saw, of which he was told, "This is for navigation," In spaceflight showed star charts upon the screens in the left-hand, smooth surface, where he saw a film. Incidentally, a number of observations have confirmed that the Janos people in the spaceship are generally right-handed, as are the majority of ourselves. Their equipment assumes right-handedness, and people touching buttons on a switchboard, a thing they seem to do constantly, do so with the fingers of the right hand. As the Great Migration Fleet began to approach the neighborhood of the solar system, which on their own statement they had never visited in modern times, the responsible officers must have felt the need for information about Earth more up to date than that in their history books. There are quite a number of late 19th century reports of airships not of any known terrestrial origin. I'm beginning to wonder whether, while I think we must dismiss all earlier sightings as non-Janos, we were starting to receive visits from advance scout ships, traveling ahead of the fleet. I have already indicated that the small moons of the 1888 diary, crewed by men with shiny clothing and with their hair cut very short, are very likely to have been from Janos. It is all in character. It is in character, also, that they should take the trouble to repatriate the near-man colony, the hairy folk who went to Janos with them, and who would have died if they were not brought back to Earth. Is this what lies behind the qualifying word most in Uxiorlia's statement, most of our people could infiltrate into your population, undetected? Such advance scout ships would have left Janos up to a century earlier than the main migration fleet. They might well have begun the business of Sasquatch repatriation, as well as initiating the intensive survey of modern terrestrial mankind that has kept the flying saucers busy right up to the present day. It has been noticed that all the localities in which Sasquatches have appeared, often loosely associated with UFO occurrences, have been such as would give them the most favorable chance of establishing themselves. Remote mountain forest country with plenty of caves, most usually, though one group of reports comes from the Everglades in Florida. It is curious that the sites are, as far as I know, all in North or South America. It has been suggested that the Himalayan Yeti is, so to speak, a Sasquatch. But there is no clear link with flying saucers, and it is more likely that the Yeti has been here all along. For advanced scout ships to be useful to the fleet command, to help in planning, it would be necessary to send information back to the approaching fleet. This could be done, no doubt, with a powerful tight beam radio transmitter, which can be received over immense distances. Alternatively, some of the earlier arriving advance scout ships might have returned to join the fleet, bringing samples and photographs, and the advantage of direct consultation without a time lag. The earliest arrivals, too, might not appreciate having to wait around for a century or so for the fleet to arrive. They could travel in their ships almost as quickly as a radio signal could go, though time would be lost in acceleration and deceleration, and in the complicated U-turn to match flight path with the advancing fleet, but no doubt it would be worthwhile. Later arrivals among the scouts would remain here and wait for the fleet, gathering information and sending back reports by radio. I suspect that the Foo Fighters of the Second World War, familiar to Air Force pilots both in Europe and in the Far East, were observation drones controlled by ships in this category. I'm dipping rather deeply into conjecture, but it all seems to me reasonable conjecture, based on what we know. I have indicated in the preface that this book makes no claim to solve all the problems of the UFO phenomenon. It is confined to giving an account of the story of the Janos people as it was told to an English family, who were for nearly an hour guests aboard one of their spaceships. I have been careful to add to this factual account only such information as seems to me to follow logically from it, bearing in mind certain background knowledge. I have mentioned the Sasquatch business at some length because, if Natasha's report is correct, and I see no reason to doubt it, it is part of the Janos story and throws some light upon it. On the other hand, Sasquatches apart, descriptions of UFO occupants, and of beings associated with UFO landings, have varied over a fairly wide range of types, far different from the strictly Nordic European type of Janos, as shown to us in this incident. There have been a great many reports of small people, between 3 and 5 feet high, with a great variety of clothing, equipment and spacecraft, though the craft vary much less than the people, and give the impression of being all derived from one technological system. There have also been reports of giants, though I am inclined to discount many of these. When I find a 6-foot man, or even a 7-foot man, described as a giant, I give up. There are plenty of 7-foot men on Earth today, particularly if one allows for a little overstatement. Where we have sincere reports of floating figures 20 feet high, of terrifying aspect, I suspect we are dealing with projected images, intended to frighten people away from something which the real people, of normal size, did not wish to be observed. The Janos story, as it has been told to us, has nothing to say concerning the small people, and certainly nothing about the more extreme oddities of the goblin or leprechaun type. There are too many little people reports to discount. There must somewhere be a basis in fact, but from this present incident I cannot offer an explanation. Only one rather thin line of evidence suggests a link with Janos. Of the 4 alien pictures shown to Natasha by Achilleus, 1, the creature called Thusantios and described by Achilleus as friendly, is drawn by Natasha as a humanoid, a distinctly goblin-like creature with long ears, and colored green all over. She shows them in her sketch as a group among houses, surrounded by some very odd-looking trees. There is a spaceship in the picture. The other 3 aliens, Vonasson, Saunus and Fawn, are less clearly drawn, but appear to be non-human. Insofar as reports of humanoids, man-like creatures, not actually human in the narrower sense, are genuine, I suspect that their ancestors all came from the Earth, and that the original reality behind the reports is drawn from various members of the hominid primates, that is, side branches of the human family and distantly related to ourselves. The Sasquatch story may be only one of many similar stories, of semi-human and near-human creatures that evolved upon the Earth, way back in tertiary times. Most of them have died out, and are known only from fossil remains. A few may still survive in wild and hidden places where they are seldom encountered. It is possible that a few may have been taken to other planets, and have returned, but whether in Janos ships, or otherwise, I do not know. Only the 1888 diary clearly indicates a Janos spaceship bringing Sasquatches from the stars. Whether they traveled, or whether they stayed on Earth, they are all our distant cousins, and originated in this planet. Terrestrial mankind has yet to meet, face to face, an intelligent being, or a being of any kind, which originated in another world. When that day comes, we shall have a surprise. I hope it will be a pleasant one. Oh, it has happened for so long, but have been covered up as we know from the military and a few of the power-greed politicans. Row. Chapter 14, Homecoming. So the Great Migration Fleet is here, somewhere in the solar system. It is understandable that they should not wish to be more specific than that. The Janos people, however friendly they may have been to our visitant family, are not naive, and indeed they have shown acute perception of the political atmosphere of Earth. Some people want to use our knowledge to control other people. Their presence in the solar system, and their expressed desire to settle permanently on the Earth, creates a political hot potato of the first magnitude, if you permit a vegetable to have an astronomical attribute. For one thing, there is going to be the very awkward, delicate, question, where are they going to live? This one is so tricky that perhaps we should defer it to later in the chapter, but as a problem it won't go away. We come in peace, if all agree. This characteristic Janos phrase reflects accurately their own political atmosphere. They are essentially democratic, much more so than any Earth nation is in practice, whatever the political theory. The stupendous, enormous, ring-shaped flagship, my term, not theirs, is where all reports go, and where the big meetings are held, as well as being a sort of grand central station for the fleet, for it is ringed with huge entry ports, so that ships can enter and leave, many coming and going at the same time if need be. It is quite certainly the largest artifact in the solar system. We do not make the decisions, we have to report everything back. All must be in agreement. There will have to be a great deal of discussion before anything is decided. One has the impression that the Genos people themselves do a fair amount of talking, and no doubt, once we get down to detailed negotiation, they will hold their own. There must be many who, like Uxiolia, speak fluent and idiomatic English, and incidents reported from other countries have indicated that some of the spaceship people can speak Spanish well, for example. See the Amo case. Our ship is one of those which have been chosen to make the first contacts. And who have been among their first contacts? Answer: John, Francis, Gloria and two little girls, Natasha and Tania. Ordinary folk, as one who knows them well, I may say very good examples of ordinary folk, but ordinary nonetheless. That is what the Genos people seem to be interested in. John put it with unnecessary modesty, why me? One hears frequently the question, why don't they talk to Chairman Hua, or Mr. Brezhnev, or Jimmy Carter, or somebody important? According to many newer informations, many of the space-traveling people have tried to make official contacts to the authorities in different countries, but they say that all these have been interested only in technology, to gain more power. And according to information now confirmed by the disclosures that Dr. Stephen Greer has made in May 2001, he has made a lot of people to talk about their UFO experiences and their working with alien technology, developing black weapon projects in secret places in especially USA. A cooperation with ETs have secretly been proceeding since the late 40s. More. The answer seems to be, as far as we can judge, that leaders and governments frankly do not interest them, and who is to say they are wrong? The Genos people have a profound sense, which we would all do well to copy, of the importance of ordinary folk, and the right of ordinary folk to have a direct voice in the making of policy decisions. How many people take part in the big meetings in the flagship, I do not know, but their mastery of electronic communication, and their constant use of visual aids, this has also been reported from several other incidents, could make possible the direct personal participation of very large numbers of people. Talking of numbers, this is a matter which is going to raise political eyebrows. With their fondness for rather imprecise general expressions, they have told us no more, concerning their present total population, than that there are enough of us to fill one of your large cities. I am taking this, thinking in terms of New York, Moscow, Tokyo, London, as being of the order of 10 million. There has been, of late, so much fuss about finding homes for a few thousand refugees, that 10 million is not going to be easy. Uxiolia told Francis that, it would be possible for most of our people, in very small groups, to infiltrate into your population, undetected, and Francis had a strong impression that they spoke from experience. But he also made it plain that such is not their desire. They wish to come openly and by general agreement. They want to have a place which is our own, where we can all be together, and be independent. Ideally, they would very much like to have an island of their own. It would need to be quite a big island. There are many questions of a more or less technical nature, which will have to be gone into, once we reach the negotiating stage. But we are not there yet. The first issue is the issue of goodwill and mutual confidence, and this is not going to be an easy one. We of this planet have been brainwashed for centuries, by writers long before H.G. Wells wrote The War of the Worlds, and more lately by film and television, into assuming, as in any case we all too readily do, that people from other worlds are necessarily sinister and hostile. Though it would be difficult to imagine anything more sinister and hostile than some of our homegrown villains. Only an hour before writing these words, I was watching a television series, clearly of American provenance, called Project UFO. It was well produced, and made use of some impressive techniques, but its purpose was a little obscure, since it seemed to be trying to suggest, A, that UFOs are hostile and will attack people and harm them, and, B, that UFOs do not really exist anyway, but are all in the imagination. I found it difficult to reconcile, first A and B. Then, still thinking of mutual confidence, try to look at it from the point of view of the people in the spaceships, and don't forget that, so far as the Genos people are concerned, Though they do come from another world, they started here, and think as we do. It is not surprising to learn, though it makes one feel sad and ashamed, that they are all the time terrified of being captured by the savages, Phil, on the ground. No, savages is not their term, it is mine. Race hatred, religious murder, pogrom Jode for Folgers, the gas chambers, Belsen yesterday, Indochina today, need I go on? Mercifully, the Janos people are intelligent enough not to generalize, and are capable of realizing that ordinary folk like John and Francis, ordinary folk in any country, are not the makers of horror and terror. These are things are done, bargaining with human lives at gunpoint, capturing women and children to extort ransom money on pain of death, blowing up innocent people who have done no harm, raping children, selling narcotics to teenagers, by monsters from another world, is it? Which are the humans? These savages lacking compassion or a sense of humor, or the people in the flying saucers? Who can say in all sincerity, please, you must not be afraid at all. We mean you no harm whatsoever. The Janos people are human, this we have established, in this inquiry, beyond any reasonable doubt. In many ways they are more human than some of those who never left Earth. But had they turned out to be aliens with green skins, big round froggy eyes and slit mouths, like some of those who have been described in UFO reports, would that have made them unacceptable? Should we not judge people by character, kindness, intelligence, humor, rather than by an anatomical description? I would rather deal with a monster with a kindly twinkle in his eye than with a heartless, humorless man. Humanity is a quality of mind. Human and humane are closely related in meaning. It was the Scottish poet Robert Burns who spoke bitterly of man's inhumanity to man. We have plenty of examples around today. Perhaps the Janos people, human with a different history, can help us to remember what human really means. An example and a strong lead, backed by the authority of great knowledge, could really start something in this tormented planet, a movement of ordinary common folk which would put an end to cruelty and inhumanity, and would assert the right of ordinary private people to decide how our world should be ordered. A movement which would keep political, military and economic power in check, and uphold the freedom and dignity of the individual. A movement which would do away with labels and categories, like Jews, Arabs, blacks, whites, reds, women, bosses, workers, and leave us as just plain John Smith and Mary Jones. No titles, no labels, just people. No masses, no categories, just individuals. The only terrestrial organization I know of, though I am not a member of it, which really thinks like this is the Society of Friends, commonly known as Quakers. It is surely not an accident that this society is known throughout the world for its practical humanity. I have a feeling that the Janos people and the Quakers would find much in common, though the Janos people who talked to John and Francis said not one word about religion. They have not come with a message or a mission, only they need a home, and have come to us, their kinsfolk, in their need. Race prejudice is unhappily with us, and cannot be ignored. I have an uneasy feeling that there are going to be large numbers of Earth people who, perhaps subconsciously, will start off on the wrong foot in their attitude to the Janos people, because the Janos people, as far as this and many other reported incidents tell us, are white people. They are, without any doubt, Europeans. They resemble most closely the Scandinavian nations, though their language, from the little we know of it, is more like Greek. The two do not necessarily exclude each other. We are talking of an age, when the ancestors of the Janos people lived on the earth before, of at least 10,000 years ago. I think we have in the Janos people an ancestral form, from which is derived the tall, blonde, slim type, with wavy flaxen hair and ice school blue eyes, which has always been accepted in European folklore as the ideal type, the fairy tale type. As to the possible Hellenic link, the very word Janos has a distinctively Greek ring to it, and Saturn is actually a Greek word. Let us remember that, while present-day Greeks conform, in general, to the Eastern Mediterranean type of European, Their classical art and ancient mythology refer back to a blue-eyed fair type as an ideal, a type identical with the Janos people of today. It is perhaps not just a coincidence that democracy, a word which essentially describes the Janos' political point of view, is a Greek word and an Athenian concept, though we should remember that the world's first parliament was in Iceland, and spoke Old Norse. Scholars know that peripheral cultures, by which they mean people who have moved away from the ancestral center, have a tendency to be conservative, retaining some older forms of the central culture, long after the center itself has moved on to new forms. The slight archaism of the French language of Quebec and the Seychelles is a case in point. It will not greatly surprise me if the Janos language, when we come to know more of it, will turn out to be allied to an archaic Proto-Hellenic. If I had to suggest a likely place of origin for the Janos people, I would be inclined to put it in Eastern Europe, perhaps in what is now Bulgaria or Yugoslavia. From there, I would expect to find that some of them moved northwest into the Baltic and Norse countries as the ice retreated, while others moved south into Greece. And one group, by what means we do not know, left the earth altogether for a distant world, and are now seeking to return to their world of origin, their birth planet. Where are we going to put them? Or rather, what place should we offer, for the Janos people have been doing their own surveying, and may have something to propose. As soon as I realized that a home was needed for something like 10 million people, with a strong desire for an island of their own, I went straight to a good atlas. I did not need to open it to know that the problem was going to be difficult, that there is a shortage, particularly, of suitable large islands which are not already overcrowded. It must have been something of a shock to the Janos people, accustomed to having plenty of room on their lost planet, to discover that the human population of Earth had grown to around 4,000 million, and is rising steeply. The Earth takes in more extra people every month than the total number of the Janos people. The land surface of the Earth, with 25 persons to the square kilometer or 64 to the square mile, is however not overcrowded as a whole. The world divides rather sharply into high-density areas and low-density areas. Broadly speaking, Europe and Asia are high-density, though there are large areas of low-density in the north, while Africa and, more surprisingly, America, north plus south, are low-density, well below average. But I am not ready yet to make named suggestions. Let us look first at the advantages of providing a home and friendship, as they ask us to do, for the Janos people, I mean the advantages to us, to the present population of Earth. I would like to think that the human race would be capable of moving over and making room for the extra Janos population, purely from humanitarian motives, because they have had much trouble, and need a home. Need it rather desperately, we cannot float around in space forever. Frankly, I have not that much confidence in our humanity. We would need to be paid. Fortunately for the Janos refugees, they are able and ready to pay for the land we give them, many times over in value. Through John and Francis, they have proposed a trade. Knowledge for land. Science for territory. Technology for acceptance. They would hope also for our friendship. But that cannot be purchased. With Janos science, technology and experience, grafted onto Earth's enormous resources, all space would be open to us. The galaxy would become the new frontier. With the Janos ability to control gravitation, to make things weightless, Earth engineering would be transformed. Cars that float above the ground, anti-grav devices for lifting impossibly heavy loads. These are only two of the immediate applications that we can vouch for in this one incident. Their medical science, immensely superior to ours, would be open to us. The medical rooms in the spaceship, which John and Francis describe, contain an intricate complex of electronic instrumentation, though it is clear that they use at least one drug administered by mouth in this incident, to facilitate hypnotic control. Where the Janos people are a very long way ahead of us is in mental science. In this connection, both John and Francis were greatly impressed by the relaxed, unstressed personalities of the people in the spaceship. A built-in tranquility was one phrase used. John said there was no hostility. The Janos people's own mental health is clearly in better shape than ours. All this we can benefit from. They could help us to solve our energy problems, though I think we all know, deep down, that the remedy is in our own hands. We use far more than we need. You seem to enjoy doing things the hard way here. Janos technology could give us what they already had on the planet, the abolition of drudgery and hard labor. You should let your machines do more for you. It was in the context of domestic technology that Uxiolia told Francis, we are far more automated, we are 200 years ahead of you. More and better science, that is what we need, and the Janos people are ready to teach us their science, centuries ahead of ours, in return for a place to live, and a home in this world, which was once their world. One thing we should not expect from the Janos people. It has become widely known, though the authorities concerned have tried to keep it hidden, that both Soviet and American military leaders hope to discover the secrets of the spaceships, to use them against each other. The Janos people themselves have told us, we can fight no more wars. It is unlikely that they would be willing to sell military secrets to East or West. This book is written during the Cold War. But if the Earth-Janos combination is attacked, as the Janos people have warned us could happen, by ships from hostile worlds, their previous experience of such attacks could help us. However, the threat is not thought to be imminent, too far to do much harm at the moment, they tell us. We could learn from each other. Unnecessary modesty on their part, perhaps, but no doubt it is true. Earth may have a lot to teach Janos, possibly in the field of the arts, entertainment, music, dance, the pleasant things of life. We are very good at these things, even if our technology is medieval. The mutual stimulus of new ideas, new points of view, comparing notes, pooling experience, could lead to an unprecedented flow of creative energy in both them and us. And, of course, most important of all, sooner or later we shall have to begin to drop this us and them business. We are all humans, more or less. Together we can conquer all space, yes, in time, in the sense that Francis felt, of peaceful expansion into the galaxy. But first we must conquer our fears of each other. Having overcome our xenophobia, our distrust and fear of strangers, on the interplanetary scale, we might bring the cure a little nearer home, and agree that Americans and Russians and Chinese need no longer fear one another. We all want to do it, all of us ordinary people, to make a world in which the fear of war has vanished. It only needs a little confidence and the breaking of some bad old fixed habits of thought, which perpetuate distrust. Something like half the world's resources go on so-called defense. We do not really need the help of the flying saucers to stop this appalling waste, which is the main cause of our backwardness and poverty, but if Janos can help us by example, and by bringing into the world a new respect for humanity as a quality of mind, then we should be grateful. What the Janos people are proposing, in effect, is a treaty of friendship and cooperation. This will have to be formalized, however it is negotiated, by the United Nations Assembly, and signed for Earth by the Secretary General. No other organization has the authority to speak for our planet. It will be the first time a decision will have been made by the people of Earth, as a whole, and an attempt should be made to associate with the decision any nations, which are not members of the UN. It is therefore necessary that the individual inhabitants of Earth should all, as far as possible, be fully informed as to the nature of the issues involved. The publication of this book makes a modest beginning of this process of worldwide consultation. The question of the readmission of the Janos people to Earth must not be decided by important people behind closed doors. It is a matter which concerns us all. Particularly, it must not become a political football between East and West. In fact, the matter of the Janos people could well be one in which East and West find a common approach. I trust that it will not be a negative one. There is a real danger of this. Once the Janos people are settled on Earth in a country of their own, they will at once qualify as a sovereign nation state, for diplomatic and other international purposes. Janos should, as a matter of course, be invited to become a member of the United Nations, and I would personally think that their extremely advanced science and technology, and by implication their enormous military potential, would make Janos a suitable candidate for a permanent seat on the Security Council. We may as well recognize at the outset that, despite their comparatively small numbers, Janos will soon acquire great power status, and will form a new and influential element in world affairs. I would suggest that it may be convenient, in the earlier stages of the settling in of Janos as an Earth nation, for one established and trusted nation to assume the quite temporary role of protecting power, though full independence should not be delayed longer than is absolutely necessary. It is important that the nation chosen for this role should not be one of the present great powers. As soon as the advantages of the position are realized, there will be a rush of candidates for the post. The United Nations should not be hasty, or too conventional, in making the appointment. The choice of protecting power will necessarily depend in part on geographical considerations, and this brings up, we can delay no longer biting into the hot potato, the question of where? Long hours of study of a good atlas have left me with little more than a headache for my trouble. I have taken as a basis of calculation the somewhat arbitrary, Vulkalig, figure of 10 million, as an order of magnitude for the present population of the Janos people in the ships. It is an interpretation of Uxiolia's phrase, there are enough of us to fill one of your large cities. Francis has a feeling that 10 million may be an overestimate. If so, a lower figure would make the problem of the resettlement of Janos on the Earth that much easier to solve, though it will still not be easy. On the other hand, we do know that Janos suffered a substantial loss of population in the disaster, which drove them out of their planetary home, and perhaps we should make some allowance for recovery. We do not know whether the Janos people are accustomed to regulate their population numbers by policy. If one takes 10 million, this is not a large population for an Earth nation, which is what Janos will become. It is comparable with the present populations of Australia, Hungary, Portugal, Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Kenya or Chile. It is less than a fifth of the population of the United Kingdom. Now how much space will the new Janos nation need? Janos will clearly be an industrialized nation, but that does not mean that they should be expected to be overcrowded to the extent of Japan, with 700, or England with 900 people to the square mile. The overall density of Europe, excluding the European portion of the USSR for which separate statistics are not available, is about 250 persons to the square mile. If we think of Janos as a nation of Europeans, at this density they would occupy 40,000 square miles or about 100,000 square kilometers. This is an area comparable to those occupied by Bulgaria, Hungary, Portugal, Liberia, Malawi, Jordan, Cuba or Guatemala. It is less than half the area of the United Kingdom. Even so, it is not going to be easy to find attractive habitable land of that size going spare, especially there is a shortage of suitable islands as large as this. The Janos people themselves, through Uxiolia and Francis, have expressed a strong desire to have an island of their own, if at all possible. This is clearly a good idea from every point of view, but not an easy one to put into practice. Islands of 40,000 square miles or more do, of course, exist in numbers. The trouble is that, with the exception of Antarctica, they are all inhabited. The total area of New Zealand, for example, is about 100,000 square miles, carrying a population of about 2.5 million. It is divided into two large islands, either of which would be sufficient for the Janos people at a European density. But New Zealanders would be unlikely to welcome the idea of giving up half their territory to newcomers, however civilized and congenial they may be, and this, I am afraid, is going to be typical of the responses of people who have islands big enough for Janos, which they could manage without. I give New Zealand only as an example, though, objectively speaking, a good and favorable one, of a part of the earth where, given goodwill and motivation, room could be found for Janos without serious loss or hardship to the displaced population. It could not be done all at once, and there would have to be substantial subsidies from world finance. But there are other possible examples. If the Janos people do not insist on an island, though I can see their point of view, the island idea is a very sound one. There is plenty of room in the interior of South America, and also in Canada if they can adapt to the severe winter cold. Australia, likewise, offers possibilities. The climate of the arid interior could be changed by a large-scale application of high technology, though I would like to see some thought given to the idea of a possible homeland for Janos in the north of Australia, having due regard for the welfare of the Aboriginal population. Africa would not be a good choice, because, although there is room to spare, it would create needless political frictions to try to introduce a large additional population of white people. There may be possibilities in Southeast Asia, but because I do not know the area, I leave it to others to offer suggestions. There would, I think, be objections to a territory being offered to Janos which was directly controlled by the United States, the Soviet Union, or China. Janos as a nation must be given the chance of making its own choice of alignment, or of remaining non-aligned. The more independent Janos can remain, the more valuable its presence will be in the earth. There remains the continent of Europe, the continent from which the ancestors of the Janos people originated, long ago. One could look at it this way, where, from an ethnic and cultural point of view, would the Janos people feel most at home? They are more like the Scandinavians than any other terrestrial group, not only in physical appearance, but temperamentally. One could think of the Janos people as space Vikings, wanderers on the galactic ocean, now returning home to the northlands of their forefathers and foremothers. Scandinavia has great numbers of islands, but only one of them is of any considerable size, Iceland, whose language and culture is perhaps closest to the Norse of antiquity. What is perhaps more to the point is that Norway, Sweden and Finland, considered together, have a lot of spare space to the northward, and, what would appeal to the Janos people, any number of lakes and fjords. Like Canada, there would be the problem of learning to live through the winter cold. I would like to see these three nations, Norway, Sweden and Finland, consider together whether they could find room between them for a new, and very old, Nordic people. Certainly there is room to spare to the northward, though due care would need to be taken to safeguard the welfare of the people of Lapland. There would be a rightness in the Janos people living once more in Europe. On the book cover, "The Janos People Speak to Us," statements given on board a Janos spaceship over England, Monday 19 June, 1978. "We are travelers. We have been traveling for a very, very long time, and we have come a very, very long way. We have been watching you for a long time. We are looking at you. We are studying you, to see if we can stay here. We cannot go back. Ship's Captain Anuxia, you are our people, because you are the same as us. We could learn from each other. You can help us by giving us a home, friendship, a chance to live again. We must have somewhere to live. We cannot float around in space forever. Together we can conquer all space. Other planets are inhabited. Not all are friendly. Too far to do much harm at the moment. Some of our people have been destroyed by inhabitants of other planets. We cannot allow this to happen anymore, so we only come in peace, if all agree. There must be no war. We do not want to cause any trouble. We have suffered too much sadness and sorrow. We cannot FTGHT more wars. We would rather die in space." Space pilot Uxie Aulia, whose wife Verna and their two young children were killed by a falling moon, with millions more. On board a Janos spaceship, over England, Monday 19 June, 1978, late one night, while traveling in their car on a lonely road in Oxfordshire, a family of three adults and two small children were intercepted by a large spaceship, and were taken on board for nearly an hour, during which the flying saucer made a short trip. They saw, on film, how the Janos people lived, their clothes, houses and gardens, boats, lakes, and food and vegetation. They watched, in horror, how a rain of giant rocks fell from the sky, as Saturn, their nearest moon, broke up and fell in fragments onto the planet, wrecking cities and covering the ground with a layer of immense boulders. They saw a nuclear power station explode as the rocks struck it, and the chain reaction which caused every power station on Genos to blow up, sending great clouds of radioactive dust swirling around the planet. They saw the immense ring-shaped ship, which was built in space, with many lesser saucer ships, to evacuate the population and take them to another world. Finally, they were told of the hopes of the Genos people. People like ourselves, numbering 10 million, who now wait in space, in our solar system, waiting to be allowed to land and start life again. This book, says the author, a retired academic with a background in biology and a research interest in the biology of humanoids, contains so many first times that I have scarcely troubled to indicate them. Ufology looks quite different after experiencing this investigation. The story is sensational. As an appendix here, some more on the case, extracts from some mail contact I have had to a person on the case. To Joe Dundovic, written as a reply from an open question found on www.onthegenoscase. This was before I got hold of the book here on the case. Read about your inquiry about the Genos people and wonder if you have got any answers. I am an engineer, constructor, live in Norway, and have information on web on UFO contacts. A clairvoyant lady, near 70 years of age, told me that she had for a long time been searching for people who knew anything about Genos. I did an interview not translated, with her, and must say she is indeed a reliable person, and had not read any UFO books, because she didn't understand English. She had for many years ago received clear telepathic messages from that civilization, and almost everything was what I had read in a report from the Genos case, but also some more. So I wonder, have you got more info on the Genos case? Sincerely, Rune Overby. Hear the answer. Greetings, Rune. Yes, I do have information re the Genos people. But first let me compliment you on your website. It is utterly fantastic. The artwork, paintings, are beautiful and mind-expanding. Very appropriate to the subjects of UFOs and cosmic consciousness. I only wish you had English versions as I cannot read Norwegian. Regarding Genos, I am also an engineer, electronics, retired, with much experience with magnetic recording. Also, have been a MUFON member for 10 years. 2. Clairvoyant lady. That interview must be very interesting. Is it possible to obtain English translation? You say she has received clear telepathic messages from the Genos civilization. I would love to know what they say. 3. Book. Have you read the book?